What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to the Pomp Podcast, simply the best podcast out there. Now let's kick this thing off. Joe Pompliano is the founder of Huddle Up, a new media platform that breaks down the business and money behind sports. He also happens to be one of my younger brothers, so this episode is packed with great stories and plenty of laughs. In this conversation, we discuss athlete investors, being paid in Bitcoin, Rich Kleiman, Kevin Durant, Saquon Barkley, Tom Brady, Sterling Shepard, Danny Boy Hustle Hard, Conor McGregor, and a number of wildly entertaining stories. I really enjoyed this conversation with my brother, and I hope you do as well. Before we get into this episode, though, I want to quickly talk about our sponsors. First up is Near. Near is an open source platform that accelerates the development of decentralized applications, overcoming high fees and slow speeds, with its fast, scalable, low-cost, and climate-neutral blockchain protocol. This is why Near was recently awarded the climate-neutral product label from the South Pole. One transaction on Near consumes about 1,300x less carbon than a similar transaction on other chains. You can learn why Near is the infrastructure for innovation at near.org. That's near.org today. You can also click on the link in the description and it'll take you right there. near.org today. Go check it out and let us know what you think. Next up is Exodus. Exodus is leading the world out of the traditional financial system by building beautiful and user-friendly blockchain products. They really do have the most beautiful products in crypto. With its focus on design and user experience, Exodus has become one of the most popular and loved cryptocurrency apps. It's supported on both desktop and mobile, allowing you to sync your wallet across multiple devices so you can have access to your funds anywhere. You can instantly exchange around 100 different cryptocurrencies straight from your wallet. Interactive charts let you view an asset's price history and your portfolio's performance over time. And maybe the best part, Exodus is integrated with the Treasure hardware wallet, making advanced security easy for everyone. You can visit exodus.com/pomp for your free download or search Exodus on the App Store or the Play Store. Again, exodus.com/pomp for your free download or search Exodus on the App Store or the Play Store. Last but not least are my friends over at Crypto.com. With 10 million plus users, Crypto.com is the easiest place to buy and sell 100 plus cryptocurrencies. The Crypto.com Visa card gives you up to 8% back instantly and 100% back on Spotify and Netflix. Also, Crypto.com lets you earn up to 8.5% on Bitcoin and 14% on stablecoins. Get $25 when you download the Crypto.com app with code POMP. Again, $25 if you go download the Crypto.com app and use code POMP. Go click on the link in the description and it'll take you right there. $25, Crypto.com app, use code POMP. All right, let's get into this episode with my brother. I hope you enjoy this one.
Anthony Pompliano runs Pomp Investments. All views of him and the guests on his podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Pomp Investments. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp or his guests as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his personal opinion. This podcast.
All right, guys, bang, bang. I've got my little brother here. We're about to oh, he's already maxed. I called him my little brother. Well, you're my little brother, right?
True, but you didn't have to say that. But
what do you want me to say? My younger?
Taller brother.
Well, you're not taller, but that's fine. We can say my younger brother, not little, younger brother. He's still littler than me. Let's get into it, though. You have blown up on the internet. Congratulations. Great job.
Thanks.
Let's start with some of these viral threads you've had. Then we're going to talk about a bunch of professional athletes that are investing. We've got some inside information maybe we'll reveal. And then we know a bunch of people who've been buying Bitcoin in the professional sports arena that we're going to talk about as well. But first, the viral threads. I don't know where you come up with this stuff. I don't know if you steal the content, you borrow it, you come up with it yourself, but it's good. And you had one recently where there's a fan who basically gave a team a loan and then ended up with $300 million.
Yeah, the gambling one.
Gambling?
Well, he was a sports gambler.
All right, explain it.
All right, let's start. So European soccer, right? There's different levels, promotion, relegation, and
much bigger than is soccer in the US.
Yes, of course, yeah. So we're talking like Premier League, right? And then the levels underneath that. So the way it works is a lot of times you'll hear like billionaires in the US, right? They'll come over and they'll buy teams and they'll try to spend a bunch of money and get them promoted. And because with promotion comes TV money and the same stuff that you would see in the NFL and the NBA and all this stuff, right?
So it's a pure investment.
For most of them, yeah. Some of them it's, you know, fun or whatever, but a lot of these guys all want to make money, similar to what they want to do with the NFL, NBA, and have fun doing it and all that. So this guy, Matthew Benham, he grew up in England. He went to University of Oxford in like late 80s, 90s, early 90s. And he was a sports gambler. So he worked like 10 years in finance. He was a physics major, really good with numbers. He got hired by a sports betting company to do predictive models with analytics. Was really good at it. Basically did it for 3, 4, 5 years. Had a falling out with this guy called Tony Bloom, who was like, he's a known sports gambler, one of the bigger guys in the world at it.
Good guy, bad guy?
I mean,
questionable.
Yeah, I mean, like everyone has their opinion on him, I think, but like he won a lot, so.
So he's a good gambler.
Good
but
gambler.
If you're a gambler, you're a gambler.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean,
that's fine.
Whatever your opinion is on that, right?
Yeah.
But so some people claim he stole the models from him. Some people claim that they don't know what the falling out essentially was, and it's not really public, but they had a falling out. They hate each other. He left. Tony Bloom kept on with the company, and he goes and he starts, Matthew Benham starts gambling his own money. Really successful 2-3 year run where he makes millions of dollars. Again, they don't know how much exactly, but not a million, not 100+ million, but somewhere kind of in between.
So, you're really going to come on here and say it's somewhere between one and 100 million?
I mean, a lot of money, right? Like, I'm not saying it's, I don't know if it's, it wasn't 500 is my point,
okay.
Right? So he gets a lot of money. He starts his own company doing the exact same thing basically that Tony Bloom was doing, predictive analytics, helping people consult for gambling, right? You go to him, you say, hey, I want to use your models. You're really good at this, obviously. Like, show me how to win, where the edge is, all this kind of stuff. So he makes a lot of money doing that. He eventually now runs an exchange. He's the CEO of a betting exchange, et cetera. But basically what that afforded him to do was go buy a team. And he didn't buy a team at first, but his hometown team, Brentford, was the club that he grew up rooting for as a kid. Went to games when he was 10, 11 years old. I think it was 2007 or 8, they got in financial trouble. They're a lower tier club, so they have a small budget. You know, the economics aren't great at a lot of these places. So basically they're gonna go under. He says, all right, the fans wanna buy the team, so the team doesn't go bankrupt. I'll provide a $700,000 loan so the fans can buy the team. And if you guys pay me back by 2012, 5 years, you'll keep going, you'll own the team, whatever. If not, there's a clause that it converts to equity and I have the opportunity to purchase more of it, right? And I can own full control of the team. 2012 comes along, team's still really struggling. Financials weren't doing great. They're struggling to get by still. So he converts it to equity, buys the rest of the team.
Okay. How much money total do you think he spent to get the whole ownership?
It's tough to tell, but maybe a couple hundred million, maybe less. A
couple hundred million?
I mean, maybe 50. I don't know. Like, they don't really know because he bought it in pieces, right? So the way a lot of these work is you buy out shareholders as it goes on. So the team maybe owned 50% at the time or 51%, and he was slowly buying out other guys. So then when his option came up, he converted it. So the aggregated price, I don't know, 50 million, 100 million, something like
okay.
that, right? So, but not billions. So he buys the club. But he takes a completely different approach. So a lot of these guys, they come in and they spend a lot of money for 2, 3, 4 years to basically try to get promoted as quickly as they can.
Yep.
And the way you get promoted is just finishing at the top of your league. If you're in the fourth division, you get finished at the top two, you get promoted, you have to finish at the top two again, and et cetera.
So winners advance basically to a higher league. Yeah, losers lose.
Yeah, completely different than the model we have here where it's closed and everyone kind of stays in regardless.
All 32 teams stay in the NFL regardless of if they're good or not.
If you're terrible, you just get the first pick, right? So completely different. But he takes a completely different approach as to kind of how he's going to make the team better. He's like, I'm really good at analytics. Let's try that. So if you think Moneyball here with the, everyone knows Moneyball, right? The Oakland Athletics, where they came in and they used analytics to kind of drive their reasoning on to why to sign players. So he does the same thing, which has historically been like a no in soccer in Europe because they think it's a game of finesse and analytics don't really tell you that much and it matters much more on individual.
That sounds like a stupid perspective.
Of course, right? So there's people will argue, you know, 100% till the death on both sides, but that was his theory. So what he does is he doesn't only just run numbers, starts firing all the coaches that don't believe in it, right? Hires guys that don't have as great background, but they believe in the numbers and they'll listen to him and all this stuff. He buys a smaller club, I think it was in Denmark, and he pays like $10 million for this club. And $10 million, a lot of money, but he basically used it as like a proving ground for his concepts. Mm-hmm. So he would try all these things there, and if they worked, he'd bring them over to the bigger club.
Got it.
So it was basically like kind of a minor league for his bigger club. So what he did was, he didn't care about wins and losses. He literally, he's famous. He wouldn't even look at the league table of the standings. He was just like, that doesn't matter. And what he would do is he would look at expected goals, how many opportunities a player was creating, stuff like that. Just key performance indicators that would tell him whether the team was improving or not. So that went on for a few years. The most drastic change that he's famous for is a lot of these teams have youth academies that essentially like Barcelona or any of these other, you know, premier clubs, by the time you're like 5-10 years old, they're already recruiting you, you're playing for them, you make your all the way up to the big team, etc. He was like, we're not going to do that anymore. We don't have the time, patience, money, whatever, to invest in all these players for this long. We're instead going to delete that team, remove them.
And
we're
delete?
Delete, remove, whatever. That's why I went back to remove. And we're going to have a B team, right? Which is guys 19 to 23 years old, 22 years old, whatever, of basically cast-offs from other clubs. So guys that played for these other Premier League teams and were deemed not good enough, not worthy, not didn't get minutes, right, in games. And they're going to come to our club. We're going to use them and play them. And his theory behind that was that you needed 35 games to be able to determine if a player was good or not, right?
Mm-hmm. Why, do we know why he came up with 35?
That's just, it's not really clear, but yeah. It's one of his models, right? So you got to remember, this is all based on his predictive models that he was using for gambling, right? Yep. So he took those same models and was applying them here. And it's funny because Tony Bloom actually owns a Premier League club too. So people are like, they joke, like he just followed the same protocol of what he did there. And Tony Bloom's club was promoted. They've been there for a few years now. So same thing. But yeah, basically, his theory was 35 games, and he would get all these players to come in. And what he did was he would give them opportunities. Sometimes it worked out, sometimes it didn't. But the ones that worked out, he'd buy them for $1 million, $2 million, and he'd sell them for $40 million, mm-hmm. right? So that was how he was able to turn a quick profit pretty easily. And then he was using that money to reinvest in the club and do the same stuff. So a lot of these concepts ended up working out. He had 3, 4, 5, maybe even more chances to get promoted. The team ended up losing a lot because the way it works is if you're in the top two, you automatically get promoted, then 3 and 4 play for the final spot. Mm-hmm. So he lost that kind of playing game a couple times, but this year he won it. So they're going to the Premier League next year. And what that comes with is anywhere there's, you know, it depends on kind of how much merchandise you're able to sell and concessions, and they just got a new stadium and all this stuff. But most estimates have it around at least $250 million in year one additional, which is way more than his budget right now. And it could be 350, 400, 500, depending on if you stay 2, 3, 4, 5 years, right? Mm-hmm. So the longer you stay up, the more money you make, but it's mostly just TV revenue, right? Now you're playing Manchester City, you're playing all these bigger clubs. So the joke is, right, like a gambler took $700,000 loan and turned it into $350 million. So that's one people really enjoyed, right? Just, I think part of it is the gambling part, which everyone kind of—
But gambling and investing is the same thing.
I knew you were going to go there.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, in equity,
it's risk reward. You're basically looking at data. If you're a professional gambler, not, I mean, there's people who just go and they're drunk and they, you know, bet on something and they lose.
Yeah. Well,
right?
That's a good point. Cause some people were like, why are we, you know, putting a gambler up on a pedestal and praising what he did? What's different than him and an alcoholic? And it's like, they're way different, right? Like he was using analytics and numbers and intelligence really to drive a return through a different market, which is similar. Yes. To your point.
Yeah, I mean, a hedge fund manager looks at data and then they risk capital for a return, and they understand the risks that they're taking. They try to find edge, right? Yeah. And they try to find some sort of data point or signal or whatever that this has lower risk and higher return than some other opportunity. And they're either right or wrong, and the market rewards or punishes them. Same thing here, where you're essentially doing the same thing. You're looking at all the data, you're risking capital, you either win or you lose, the market rewards or punishes you. And if you have a significant advantage in the data when you're gambling, it's incredibly profitable. Same thing in the stock market, right? Mm-hmm. If you can figure out something that other people haven't figured out yet, until it gets commoditized away, it's an advantage.
Well, I would say that two things on that is, one, significant is 5% in gambling, right? Like you only have to be 5% better than the average model and you can make a lot of money on it because just the way the odds work. But outside of that, it's clearly the same thing because he used the same models for gambling that he did for the team investment, right? Right? Like he was using the same stuff and just, you know, you altered a little bit for kind of the outcomes, but he was using the same models and the same analytics and data. He just used it for two completely separate things.
I don't know if you've done this. If not, you should do a thread on this. Have you seen the Susquehanna investors, Susquehanna Investment Group, SIG? Yeah. They started out horse betting.
No, horse, I haven't seen that, but yeah, I know
they used to go to the horse tracks, and that's how they originally got started. Was they were basically they figured out a bunch of mathematical things, and they would go bet and they would win a bunch of money. And then somebody was like, "Hey, man, that works for horses. Like, you should look at stocks."
Yeah,
that's and awesome. Like now they're a huge market maker investor and all this stuff. All right, what's one more thread that's gone viral that people really enjoyed?
Well, you have one of mine.
Do you not remember any of them?
No, I mean, I remember them, but...
All right, well, what's your favorite one recently?
I don't know, dude. I gotta like...
You gotta think about it?
Yeah. Like, what did I do recently? The McGregor one's great.
All right, what's that one?
The McGregor one was great.
Conor McGregor.
Conor McGregor, yeah. Conor McGregor's story is just cool because like it's like a movie, right?
We should call out. There's a lot of people who don't like Conor McGregor.
Yeah.
There's also a lot of people who like him. And then there's a bunch of people in between who say, hey, there's some stuff he does that I don't like, but I also respect.
That's me.
The hustle, the middle one.
I'm in the middle.
Yeah. All right.
So
I'm probably in the middle as well.
Yeah. And right, like I think it goes both ways, right? Like he's had allegations of crimes and all this stuff that I don't know if he did or he didn't do, but I don't necessarily obviously agree with the punching people in bars, stupid stuff, right? But when it comes to his ability to promote himself and make a living and doing all these things. And,
as a fighter, his superiority within the cage.
Clearly works extremely hard at that and all this kind of stuff, right? And just the ability to distinguish himself as a personality, right? There's hundreds of, you know, thousands of UFC fighters that were unable to do what he did, right? Mm-hmm. And he's really transformed the sport, not only from his ability, but his promotion of it.
Is right? he like the Muhammad Ali of the UFC? Like from a branding and a promotion standpoint?
That's what I was going to say is like, he's clearly not the best fighter, right? I think that's been proven. He's lost multiple matches in a row and all this kind of stuff. But from a promotion standpoint, he's the biggest ticket by far.
So okay.
Not even close.
Right? All right. So what's his story?
So he grew up in Ireland, right? He was from a family that was just not super wealthy or anything like this, right? He blue collar family, moved towns when he was younger, 16 years old, got into UFC, him and another guy, Chris Egan, they were-
mixed martial arts, right? Not UFC,
MMA.
MMA.
So he actually started boxing. He would go to the gym. And the reason why he started doing that was because he was getting picked on, right? So it's literally like a movie, right? Like he was getting bullied. I think the story is he walked home from school one day and they threw like a rock at him or something. And then they came up to him. And his first thought was, so he went home, he said he sprinted home, didn't look back, like just scared. He goes to school the next day. He went to school every day from then on with a dumbbell in his backpack, like a weighted dumbbell. And he was like, yeah, like y'all came at me once, but if you try it again, like something's gonna happen. And obviously he realized pretty quickly like that was dumb and he started going to boxing classes. So okay. He goes to boxing classes.
What's he gonna do, knock guys out with a dumbbell?
Exactly, right? So I don't know if it was like the next day he started boxing or like a month from that.
Can you imagine the teacher being like, hey man, looks like your backpack's kind of heavy, but yeah, you got 30 pound dumbbells back there. It's
clearly there were no books in there at that point. Right. So he goes and he starts taking boxing classes. His family, he does that for 5, 6, 7 years. I don't think he was like competitive boxing, but it was training and kind of mm-hmm. doing all that stuff. His family moves towns. He goes to high school in kind of a different area, an hour and a half away. He meets another guy named Chris. They start taking up MMA. Right. So they're at first, it's not like, hey, we're going to start training. They just fall in love with the UFC. So they start seeing people fight mm-hmm. in the UFC. It's really early at this point. The UFC started in the early 90s. So it's established, but it's not the biggest ticket in the world yet. So they start watching the fights, practicing the moves, they start training, et cetera. And he basically is like, okay, I'm not going to college. I need to make money. I am not in any professional UFC competitions or anything, so I need to go get a job. So he starts plumbing. He's an apprentice for a plumber, right? So it's funny looking at McGregor now and imagining that, but you know, he was a young kid at this
point. And he was like riding a bus or something, right? Like every day?
So he would wake up at 5:30 in the morning, jump on a bus to basically the train, meet a random guy there that he knew, right? It's like a construction job. So he's meeting these guys there that he doesn't know, and they would
scoop him up.
They would travel to the spot for the day that they're working, work, you know, 7 a.m., 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. at night, all day long. And then he would have to either go find time to train or, you know, do all the other stuff. He was getting paid terrible. And he just jokes, he's like, I knew pretty quickly it was not what I wanted to do. Right? Just like from the standpoint of, he was like, my back was hurting. These guys all looked miserable. Like he's like, I totally respected the work and respected them, but just from like a quality of life, wasn't interested. So he makes a decision. I think it was within like 6 months, maybe 3 months, maybe even less, where he's like,
I thought it was like within like 2 weeks. He was like, yeah,
maybe it was even less. And he's just like, screw it. I'm going to double down on this fighting thing. Like I'm going to try it. Mm-hmm. Right. And people got to remember at this point, like, he's 18 years old, 19 years old. He doesn't have any jobs, no income.
Lives at home with his girlfriend.
Living at his parents' house with his girlfriend in the same, you know, same house, all that kind of stuff. They're making him meals, that, you know, the whole thing. And his family's not like super well off either. So there's, you know, he jokes that he was letting he owed taxes to the government. He was on welfare and all this stuff, right? And his girlfriend's working to support both of them at the time. And he's just training all day long now. So he was like, I couldn't train at first. Now I'm going to do it all day long and I'm going to make something of myself. So it's kind of a movie in the standpoint of now everyone knows who he is, but yeah, he fought in Ireland for a couple years.
Didn't he lose the first two fights?
Yeah, so he lost I think he won his first fight, but then he lost, like, he was like 4-0 or 4-2, and he lost back-to-back fights, got down on himself. He was hurt. He was out for like a year, and then he came back, and that's when he won. Like, he basically, there's a few stories about kind of what motivated him when he was away. He read some books and stuff, and he claims, like, my mindset just changed. He claims he just, now he's like an animal where he's training all day, doing all this stuff. But yeah, he comes back, gets signed by the UFC. Dana White flies over, sees his fight, and he's like, dude, this guy's nuts. You know what I mean? Like, he's just like, because he was doing the same stuff he does now, which is the funniest part, is he was literally doing the exact same stuff, like running around the ring, screaming, jumping on stuff, press conferences, same thing, you know, like, and
he was a star who just didn't have the stage yet.
Yeah, and like, there's stories of him just like, you know, talking trash to people at the weigh-ins and stuff. And it was just like, he wasn't McGregor, so everyone was kind of like, this is weird. But now it's like, you know, it's genius. So Dana White sees him and he's like, yeah, this guy's a star.
Like, like, all I gotta do is put a camera in this guy's face.
As long as he can live up to the hype, like, in the ring, like, total home run. So he gives him a contract for a couple UFC fights. His first fight is actually a hilarious story because he wins, gets knockout of the night.
And knockout, just so people understand, if you fight, you get a guaranteed minimum.
Yeah.
If you win,
which at that point is minuscule. It's your first fight.
20 grand, yeah. 10 grand, whatever. Yeah. If you win, you get like a winner's bonus.
Yep.
And then there's like, for the night of across all the fights, a knockout of the night, a couple of bonuses.
Yep.
And if you get the knockout of the night, then you basically, you got paid for winning and you got paid for the knockout.
Yeah, it's an additional bonus basically, right? But it's bigger than the other one. So he wins knockout of the night and he gets a $60,000 bonus. And at this point, he had never seen that much money, right? And there's, people got to look it up. There's a video of it. He stands up at the thing and he just yells.
And he grabs a microphone.
Yeah, I think it's Dana White, 60 G's, baby. And Dana's like, told you, home run. Right? He's like, this is great. And the best part about the whole story is, I think he bought his girlfriend a car with the 60 grand, right? Like,
didn't save it.
But that's
no,
just him,
no
right?
Financial education whatsoever. Just like, yo, I'm buying you like a Range Rover or something.
Yeah. And it's funny because people know him now, right? He was the highest paid athlete in the world last year, which based off a few business deals that, you know, we can go into or we can't, but basically he's obviously good with his business and his money and all this stuff. But that was just his mindset, was like, he was an entertainer. You know what I mean? He was just like, Dana, 60 G's, went and bought a car. He's celebrating. And I'll, if anyone's seen his, I don't know if you've seen it, his documentary on Netflix. It's Notorious.
Yeah, Notorious, yeah.
My favorite part of the whole thing is he wins one fight, literally the first fight.
I know exactly what you're going to talk about, where he's on the iPad.
He's on the iPad, like sitting on the toilet taking an interview, and he's just yelling.
Ariel Helwani, right?
Yeah. And he's got the sunglasses on. And he's just yelling, I'm the best in the world, all this stuff.
I'm going to be world champion.
Yeah, I'm going to be world champion. I'm the best in the world. It's incredible. And his girlfriend's like in the room in his parents' house. And she's like, dude, we don't have any money.
She's like, you literally won your first fight. Yeah, you got paid 60 grand. Yeah. And now you think that you're Muhammad Ali.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And it's great from an entertainment perspective, obviously. But honestly, I think he truly believed it too, right?
Like, well, he did become the world champion.
Became the world champion, multiple weight classes, all this stuff, right? And off. Out of the octagon, he's done extremely well. He had the kind of the liquor company, the whiskey company, Proper 12, that he sold this year. Highest paid athlete in the world, right?
So, all right. So, how does he become the highest paid athlete in the world?
Yeah. So he makes, you know, pay per view wise, maybe a few million bucks a year on the best years when it comes out of the ring. He made a ton of money, $150 million plus when he fought Mayweather. But that's kind of once in a.
Okay, so take out the Mayweather fight for a second. He made $180 million last year.
Yep.
And of that $180 million, how much was in the octagon versus outside?
A few million in the octagon.
So $5 million, $10 million.
Yeah.
And everything else was outside.
Yeah. And most of it is, you know, in a typical year, maybe he earns $10, $15, $20 million on endorsements. Kind of just like, hey, your typical stuff. Promote our products, Monster Energy, all the typical ones that you would you see in the octagon and all these other places. Beats, all those. But then he did the liquor company, right? The whiskey, Proper 12, which was genius because obviously you've seen a bunch of these pop up with Aviation Gin and Ryan Reynolds and The Rock and, you know, all these different ones that people have had just massive exits. And he was probably like in the middle of that. We see a lot more now. And there was a couple early ones that really were successful. He was kind of on that second tier of like, hey, there's a blueprint for this. I'm going to team up with the right guys who have done this and we're going to go attack it.
Ken Austin.
Yeah. And, what they did was exactly that. He was just promoting it, right? Mm-hmm. And they had a deal in place with kind of distributors already where it was like, hey, you guys are going to manufacture this. You're going to distribute it. You're going to kind of just plug and play it into your network already. And we're going to promote the hell out of it. And we're going to see how much we can sell. Mm-hmm. And they had milestones that if they hit, they would exit the business. And those were hit over the last, you know, 3-4 years where, hey, we hit this milestone, buy an additional 20% of the business. We hit this one, buy an additional. And those aren't the correct numbers necessarily, but they're just an example of kind of how the deal worked. And this year was the last exit of the deal. He's still a promotional partner. I'm sure there's still kind of maybe a little bit of equity or whatever, at least kind of payments for marketing and stuff. But he made like $150 million the estimate, which is
for 60 G's, yeah, baby. Yeah,
right. And the craziest part about that whole thing for me is like, never in the wildest imagination would you think that a UFC fighter would be the highest paid athlete in the world. But yeah, it just shows the branding, the promotion, the marketing, and what he turned himself into from all of that, right? But the highest paid UFC fighter in the world, maybe usually max makes $5 million a year, $10 million a year.
Yeah. Outside boxers make more than the UFC folks and the whole nine yards. Yeah.
I mean, there's a reason why Jake Paul and Logan Paul got into boxing, not UFC. I was saying, one, because they'd get killed, but two, because the money's obviously
how greater. Bad would it be if they stepped into an octagon?
With a guy like McGregor?
Yeah, sure.
Just, well,
like best of the best?
Yeah.
It'd be bad.
It would be really bad. Yeah.
All right. And so that's also why the celebrity boxing matches are so interesting, is because they're basically, they're poking the bear, right? Both Jake and Logan are poking the bear, trying to get the UFC fighter saying, hey, you're not getting paid enough money. Come over here and do celebrity boxing. Yep. And what's unique about it is a lot of the MMA folks actually aren't good boxers, right? And this is coming from somebody who, I'm not a good boxer either, right? So like, it's just, they're much more well-rounded. They're not an expert at boxing. Boxing is one of the many disciplines that they have to be good at to be a good UFC fighter. And so what they're essentially trying to do is almost get the UFC, get the names to come into the ring and do boxing, which Jake and Logan are better than they were a year or 2 years ago. Yeah. I don't know. We went to the fight. Like, I was pretty impressed with
they're
Logan.
They're obviously not bad boxers.
Going eight rounds with Floyd Mayweather. Like, I don't think any of us expected that.
I was
going
to say, it's also like threading the line a little bit too of like, hey, I mean, Mayweather's an extreme example of going the full way. But what Jake has done really well is like, I'm going to be a boxer. I'm going to be legit to some degree of like, you know, fighting real fights and training hard and doing all this stuff. But I'm going to fight UFC guys that, you know, maybe like you said, lack a little bit of that.
Can we talk about Ben Askren?
Yeah.
What do you want to talk about? Ben, I love you. I need to know, did you train? Ben, I love you to death. You're the smartest person I know because you got paid. I know you got paid. Everyone knows you got paid. Yeah. But we need to know. You think he trained?
I saw the video of him running in his yard in the snow and stuff like
Come
that.
On.
But outside of that, I'm not sure. he showed up on the way, and those photos were viral. It was all time. Yeah,
I don't know. Incredible. I saw a picture of Ben and Amy. Amy's his wife. They were walking in the hallway afterwards. They were laughing. That looked like the face
smile.
That looked like the face of a mad genius to me.
We got paid. That was that face. Yeah.
I love you, Ben. If that's what happened, you're the absolute OG of all of this. All right. Let's talk about some other investors that are athletes. Mm-hmm. I know that you've gotten to know Rich Kleiman and 35 Ventures and a bunch of what they've done with Kevin Durant. What is Rich Kleiman doing? Let's just talk about Rich.
Rich is an OG.
I know.
You know him too. He's great, right? He's awesome.
What's his deal?
He manages Kevin. He runs 35 Ventures, their venture capital kind of investment shop. And
what do they invest in?
Everything. Technology. He did 100 plus investments at this point, right? And some big wins. Coinbase. What was the food delivery startup?
DoorDash.
DoorDash, right? So they invest in a bunch of companies. They're investors in Dapper Labs, all these, you know, these mostly technology focused, I would say. But I think they do some consumer products and stuff like that. But he runs that. Boardroom, which is their kind of media arm of everything, sports business wise. But he's a busy guy, but he
Rich Kleiman forever will get my respect because I saw him. He was doing an interview and he was sitting in his corner office in New York City, and he looked just smooth. And he had sunglasses on while he was doing the interview. And I said, "Hey man, ain't nobody screwing with Rich Kleiman. Rich Kleiman's the top of the world. He got the sunglasses on the interview."
Yeah, Rich is great, and they've built a great business, right? Like on the court, Kevin obviously is a great player.
Killer. Last night.
Oh yeah. Well, I don't know what day this is going to release.
Tomorrow.
But, the Bucks playoff game last night, I think 45 points, 17 assists, 12 rebounds, whatever it was, right?
Were only player in history to do that. There? You
it happened last the, night. The I have a good memory.
Yeah. Got Jimmy Neutron looking head. I promise I wasn't going to make fun of him the whole time, but whoops. all right. So Rich and Kevin, how do they get the deal flow? Like, is it now just in the beginning, it was like, hey, let's work really closely with venture capitalists and we'll kind of invest alongside them. And now like they just built a name for themselves. And so people come to them for deals. Like, how does it work?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure that... I don't want to speak for them, right? Because I think their answer might differ to some degree just based on kind of being in the trenches on that. But he played in Golden State, right? So that's kind of where you want to be, at least back then in 2017, whatever it was, from a venture capital perspective, made incredible relationships. And I think the people that, I think the thing that most people understand is like, athletes want to talk to VC investors and VCs want to talk to athletes, right? So Kevin was a natural guy that, you know, they're sitting courtside, they want to talk to the players, the best players, all that kind of stuff. So I think you naturally learn some of that through those relationships. You obviously get brought a lot of deals through that. You are interested in investing, you want to learn, you make that clear to them, they bring you deals, you talk to them. You can obviously provide value for Kevin, whether you have kind of his own traditional distribution on social media, YouTube, all that kind of stuff, or through the boardroom and kind of all that kind of stuff. So I think it was a combination of, hey, this guy can be super value for some of these investments that we're doing, mm-hmm. and then Kevin being super interested in the investing stuff.
How important was it that he went to Golden State for a lot of this?
I mean, one, from like a basketball standpoint, like traditional fans love to hate on the fact that he went there and teamed up with all these players to win. But at the end of the day, I don't remember his exact quote when he did it, but it was just like, when the game's over and you retire and it's 50 years from now, the only thing people care about is championships. They don't care about who you did it with. People forget all of that, right? Like guys that are not born yet, they won't have any clue what the heck happened to get him those championships. They just care about championships. So that's what he went and did. He wanted to win, their style of play, all that kind of stuff. So from a basketball standpoint, it was great. Investing wise, he couldn't have done anything better, right? Because you're teaming up with world-class investors out there. You're meeting some of the brightest minds in the world. And not only are you creating personal relationships, but you're seeing the deal flow, you're mm-hmm. investing alongside them. They want you in, they want your check, all this kind of stuff. So I think it was just amazing from both perspectives, basketball and there. And obviously it worked out on the court and then off the court with some of the exits it's worked out too.
They got a nice ass office in New York City.
Yeah. Rich Klein. My favorite was the guy downstairs.
Yeah, you want to tell that story?
Yeah, we rolled up to the office once and what, the door was locked, right?
Yeah, so well, Joe and I went, it was at night too. It was like, we went and met Rich at like 6 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
And when we walked up, you'd been to the office before, right? So you knew where we were going, but we walked up, I think Joe tried to open the door.
I didn't see this guy the first time, though.
And it was locked. And while we're waiting a second, trying to figure out, you know, is there a bell to ring or whatever, I just looked kind of at the street and there was a black like Suburban or Escalade, whatever, sitting there. And there was a dude who obviously was not just a driver. He's a big dude.
Yeah.
And I think he even might have had his sleeves rolled up and had like a tattoo or something on his forearm. And he just kind of looked over at us. And there was a second there where I was like, what's this guy doing here?
Yeah, like you could tell he was doing something there, but you didn't quite know what it was.
Like we didn't know, was he there for us or was he there for somebody else?
Yeah, he had that look in his eyes. But
And so when we went upstairs, we made sure that we told Rich, hey man, don't be sending nobody to come get us.
Yeah. And
which he thought was
funny. I saw him later on a different time and he's like, you know, exactly what you would expect. Ex-cop, right? Parks wherever he wants. Takes care of everyone.
He's
on the block.
Man.
Yeah, great guy, right? I talked to him for 5 minutes. He was awesome. Yeah. But it was just funny seeing him the first time and like, what's going on here?
All right. The next person I want to talk about is Saquon. Saquon Barkley. We've gotten to know him, Ken Katz, Connor, all these guys. We'll talk about Danny Boy Hustle Hard in a second. You know we're going to talk about him. But Saquon is fascinating because he is what you and I would say is the best running back in the NFL. Go Giants. And
I was going to say, do we have to put a disclaimer on that?
No, it's just facts. It's it is a fact. Saquon Barkley is the best
Giants
NFL
fan
running back.
Yeah.
And now he's starting to get really, really interested in investing. So like maybe walk through, like take somebody like Saquon as he becomes more interested in this, like what's the journey for an athlete to become an investor and kind of get much more kind of exposure and deeper into those circles?
Yeah. And I think it's not only what we were just talking about with Kevin, but what we've talked with Saquon about, which is like, you come into the league, you're making some money, you're figuring out what you want to do, you get comfortable for a little bit of time, you do endorsements, you get your name out there, you build your brand, distribution, all that type of stuff, right? All the things that are important when you start investing. So he's done that for a couple of years now. And then I think it's what he's really been trying to do is just build those relationships, right? Those same things that we talked about Kevin with in Golden State is like, you call up the 5-10 best investors you know, the guys that have the best returns or women that have the best returns on Wall Street, and you say, hey, look, I want to learn. I just want to learn. I don't even want you to give me access, all this stuff. And what you find is it's that same thing. They want to talk to the athletes. Athletes want to talk to them. You build that relationship. They care about you because they're seeing, hey, he really wants to learn. And then they start bringing you deals naturally, right? And you get the same access that they have. And you provide value. It's not like they're just handing you favors, but Saquon has a massive fan base, especially when you look at it from like sports technology companies and things like that, that he'll invest in over time. He provides tremendous value. So I think it's more about just learning at first, figuring out what you like and what you're interested in investing, and then seeing that deal flow from these guys.
All right. Saquon, love you. You're going to be an absolute genius on the investing front. Let's talk about all of our favorite human in the whole world, Danny Boy Hustle Hard.
Yeah.
Who, maybe first let's just start with, who is this?
Well, why don't we just tell the story about the first time we met him? Which was... So we went to dinner with these guys and we were going out to New Jersey, right? And we get Danny Boy, who's the driver for Saquon.
It's not Danny Boy, it's Danny Boy Hustle Danny Hard. Boy,
yeah, sorry, I don't want to just do the first name here. We're got Danny Boy Hustle Hard from New Jersey.
Absolute legend in the tri-state area. Yeah. We were told Danny Boy Hustle Hard, who, for those that don't know, drives a ton of celebrities, ton of athletes, etc., all throughout New York, New Jersey, that... anywhere you need to be in the tri-state area, Danny Boy Hustle Hard will get you there in 10 minutes.
Oh, yeah, 10, 15 maybe. But
10,
yeah.
15 minutes, anywhere you need to be, he's got you. And so when you hear that, you're like, man, there's some areas where it might take you an hour and a half. Yeah. Don't worry, 10, 15 minutes, he's got you.
Yeah, like I've never gotten to MetLife in 10 minutes.
So, from the stadium. Yeah. So as part of the experience of meeting him, he came to pick us up in New York City, Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And maybe let's just start with literally how we knew which car he was in order to get in the car with him.
So like me or you, we gave him an address, right? He's, I'll meet you on the corner. It's like, dude, I gave you an exact address, right? Which,
but he doesn't want to turn on the street. Yeah, I'll just meet you at the corner.
Typical New York kind of personality and driver, right? So meet you on the corner. So we're out there waiting on the corner. And instead of a text or a call, hey, I'm pulling up, whatever, we see him.
We're
literally sitting on the corner. We see him pull up. Almost goes down a one way.
The wrong way.
The wrong way. Backs out, then parks on like basically the curb where the buses are supposed to go, and just lays on the horn. Just lays on the horn, and not like a quick beep like, hey, I'm over here. Like a, hey, this is me, come find me.
And you and I looked at each other and we're like, I guess that's him.
Yeah, yeah. We're like, no one else would do that. So that's him, yeah. But then-
we get in the car.
Yeah, I mean-
say, what's up? He says, what's up, Cheech?
Yeah. Multiple cell phones are ringing. Well, I'm like,
and we had to go maybe 45 minutes away.
Yeah,
I think we got there in 25 minutes. How do we get out of Manhattan?
So I mean,
to be fair,
we knew 2 minutes into the ride that
craziest experience I've ever had in Manhattan. Also, absolute legend, Danny Boy Hustle Hard.
He's unique as a driver because it's pretty reckless the whole time, but you're completely comfortable the whole time also. Like he's talking, he's chatting, and he's just doing his thing.
He runs every red light.
Yeah. I didn't know if we were really supposed to say that.
He's
Danny. Listen, boy, hustle hard.
Yeah, he goes hard. Yeah. And every single maneuver he uses to get through that tunnel, you're sitting there and you're like, this guy could win the Indy 500. Yeah. He literally could drive a Chevy Suburban and win the Indy 500. That's how good of a driver he is.
Yeah.
And the entire time he's doing it, he is making you die laughing.
Yeah.
And you literally feel like you could not be safer.
Yeah.
It is a skill.
He's great at it. Yeah. Way back too. Had dinner with us and then way back. Yeah. We probably even got back quicker on the way back.
My favorite thing that he does by far is the entire time he just keeps laying into anything that you would think might be controversial, he has an opinion. Yo, Cheech, let me tell you. And I don't know where that word came from, but Cheech is the chosen nomenclature for how he addresses you. It's just, hey, Cheech.
Yeah, he seeks out those topics, really, is what it is. He'll like bring up a question that is like controversial a little bit. You'll like kind of skirt it a little bit to some degree, and he'll just go straight in.
On a scale of 1 to 10, 1 not being not funny, 10 being hysterical, where do you put him?
Oh, he's a 10.
Oh, I think he's like 11 or 12. Yeah, like he's off the charts funny.
Yeah,
we hilarious. Our brother John is funny, but like Danny Boy Hustle Hard makes John look like a mime.
Yeah, he's great. Yeah, and the best part about the whole ride, you let me know if you're flying in anytime you want to ride. I was dying. Yeah. He's like, yeah, we got your number.
All right. So Danny Boy Hustle Hard is, he drives all kinds of professional athletes, et cetera, all throughout New York City. Legend. If you do not follow him on Instagram, highly, highly recommend the follow on Instagram. Literally, you will be laughing on the floor at how funny this guy is. But a bunch of other athletes also come through. Some of them are investors in Bitcoin. Let's talk about athletes who have decided to get paid in Bitcoin. What exactly is going on there? Who's done it and why are they doing it?
Yeah, so there's a few of them, right? And I think the main guys that everyone knows about are Russell Okung. Sean Culkin did it last. Russ, I think he took 50% of his salary, right? He said it kind of November of last year.
He gets paid like $13 million a year, and yeah, he took 50% of his salary in Bitcoin.
Yeah, $6.5 million a year. Said, pay me in Bitcoin. Sean.
He actually tweeted that too.
Yeah, pay me in Bitcoin. And then he said, paid in Bitcoin.
When he did it, which was the best part.
Yeah, yeah, how it started, how it ended, right? But so Sean Culkin, he was a tight end for the Kansas City Chiefs. Same thing. He said, I'm going to take 100% of my salary though. So he's a kind of a veteran minimum player, makes $1 million a year, said, I'm going to do 100%, all $1 million. I want paid in Bitcoin. So, I mean, you know, the way these things work, like they're not actually physically, the team is not buying Bitcoin, holding it on their kind of balance sheet and paying them, but the transaction is facilitated and they get paid in Bitcoin.
Via Strike.
Yeah. Good plug.
Hashtag investor.
Yeah.
Strike's taking over the world.
Yeah. So they
El Salvador, Strike, the NFL, whatever you need, we got.
Yeah. So they use Strike and they've been taking their salary in Bitcoin. And part of it is kind of like, hey, why don't you just buy Bitcoin? Like some of these guys, Russ has been buying Bitcoin for years, right? So it's kind of like, why don't you just keep doing that and do the same thing? But I think it's two things. One, like they're opting out of traditional the US dollar to some degree, right? But also they're just believers in it, right? And they're showing,
they're making a statement,
and that's really what it is it's statement. You can call it marketing, whatever you want, but really what it is this what I believe in, this is why I'm doing it, etc. So Okung, same thing. Sean Culkin, same thing. The one I thought was interesting was Trevor Lawrence, right? Where he said I'm gonna take my endorsement, the money from FTX.
Oh, Blockfolio. Yeah, Blockfolio.
Yeah. So Blockfolio paid him his basically what was equivalent of the signing bonus of the deal, all in crypto.
Not Bitcoin, other stuff, right? Or was some Bitcoin?
Some was Bitcoin, like a third of it, Bitcoin, a couple other coins.
Got it.
So he got
part of it. He just went all in on all kinds of weird coins.
No, there was three of them. And I forget exactly what it was, but there was three of them. Bitcoin was one of them. And he took, you know, a third, I think.
What's up with the GOAT, Tom Brady? Mine, let's just caveat, Tom.
Lost two Super Bowls.
Yeah, you're 0-2 in the Super Bowl against Eli Manning. I love you. You're great. You got to respect
great
your greatness.
Player.
Yeah, you multi Super Bowl champion, but against Eli Manning, the best quarterback to ever grace the NFL as a Giant, you're 0-2.
Especially from a meme perspective.
Yeah, I mean Eli Manning is 2-0 against the GOAT in the Super Bowl. If you beat the GOAT twice in the game that matters, then you're the GOAT, right?
Yeah.
Whatever, shout out Eli. All right, go ahead. What do you think him and his whole Bitcoin foray?
I mean, he hasn't, you know, come out and said, hey, I'm taking salary in Bitcoin or whatever, but he's got the laser eyes on Twitter. Everyone loved it. He spoke at the conference. He's obviously into NFTs with kind of the platform he's working on and everything like that. So I think it's the same stuff. And the more, one of the things that stuck out to me was when Russ did and he got paid and they came out and said, hey, we're going to pay you. And he was up big and all this stuff. And it was going viral on the internet. He was like, I'm having tons of athletes reach out to me, right? And he said the exact same thing when Tom Brady did it. When Tom Brady put the laser eyes, he was like, all these NFL guys are interested. One, because it legitimizes a little bit, right?
Yeah.
He comes out and he says, hey, look, I'm invested in it. I own Bitcoin, other crypto, whatever it is. But in our quarterback room, we talk about it every day. He said, our quarterback coach has been in it for a while. He's kind of, you know, got all of us on the same train and stuff. So when a guy like Tom Brady does it, whether you think he's the best investor in the world or not, he's obviously super respected from kind of a, not only a football player, but a business perspective and kind of who these guys look up to. So I think he was a major turning point for people in sports of like, hey, this is legit. Like, we should go check this out, right?
I don't want to put it on blast. Let's not say the sport or the team, but we've been told a story by the people involved, so we know for sure it's true, that there was a team that during halftime of important games, they would be checking their Coinbase wallets or their accounts, showing each other how much money they made or lost in crypto and Bitcoin. And literally the coach at one point had to be like, hey, put your phones away. Yeah, like, we got a game to play.
At halftime. Yeah. What do you do if you're a coach in that standpoint?
I mean, you're like, put your phone away. We have a game to play.
Yeah,
and the player's like, yo, coach,
we're making money.
You see how much Bitcoin I just stacked? Like, I'm out here. Like, I'll see you.
Yeah.
What's fascinating to me, though, is like some of these players, do you think that they would literally retire if they were a billionaire? You think some of these players would just walk away?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you got to remember too, specifically like football, right? Like,
because your body.
Yeah. Saquon has never said this, so I'm not going to speak for him, but a position like a running back, you're getting killed out there, right? You're constantly hurt. You're rehabbing. You're doing surgery, all this stuff. Like,
oh, no, man. He was throwing the deuces up. Ain't nobody touching him.
Yeah, no, of course. Like, he's an incredible athlete, right? But just from the perspective of, like, it's a physical game, if you're a billionaire, at some point you're like, all right, I don't really want any head injuries, concussions, knee injuries, whatever it is. Like, I'm just going to go chill and retire, right? Yeah. And maybe you find something else to do or whatever it is. But if you told these guys, I mean, guys have literally told us, not those guys, but like other guys, they're like, yeah, I'd be out. Yeah. So like, it's, yeah.
You know who we should talk about that we haven't mentioned yet? Probably one of the funniest people in the NFL is Sterling Shepard.
Yeah.
I'm going to plug him for his advertisements because this guy is hysterical. And then you look at his Instagram and he's taking photos with like bars of soap next to the bathtub
with his kids. And he's like, yeah, go buy this soap. And when I mean,
hashtag getting paid.
Yeah. When we met him, I was like, these are the same people. He's just, and not in like a, he was like a ridiculous perspective, but he's just hilarious, right? He's just like me or you. He's the normal guy, hilarious. And like, it's just funny seeing two way different perceptions of him.
But I think that's why folks, there are certain players that everyone gravitates toward. Like, man, I like that guy, right? Yeah. And maybe you can't, you don't like personally interact with him, whatever, but like the authenticity comes through.
Yeah.
It's probably also why the brands like certain players, right? It's like, oh, this person's really authentic. They, the audience feels like they're relatable. They, you know, we don't have to worry about them going, doing crazy stuff or whatever. And it just seems like a couple of the people that we've talked about, like they all kind of hit those marks, and that's why they get the endorsement deals. That's why brands want to work with them, all that type of stuff.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. I mean, look, he was super personable, obviously, right? Like, super good guy, but hilarious. And he relates well on the field. He plays for the Giants. That obviously helps. He's good at football, all that.
Could you beat Saquon or Shep in a 40-yard dash?
Is that a serious question?
I don't know. Could you? I could. Easy. Let's go. How much Bitcoin are we going to put
on? What's your 40-yard dash?
Split second faster than either one of them.
Okay, so Saquon probably ran like a 4.4 at the combine.
Oh, well, I run a 4.3 then.
All right, we're going to test that out.
Listen, that's what I want. And rather than do celebrity boxing, I don't need a box.
40-yard dash.
Let's do 40-yard dash. But I'm getting paid before. I mean, Mayweather, even if he lost the match, he got $30 million on his shorts. Like, I'll run against Saquon for money.
Do you believe that?
Yeah, sure, let's go.
I mean, he said it, yeah.
Yeah, whatever, that's fine. Oh, do I believe that Floyd Mayweather got $30 million? Oh, yeah. I think that he probably didn't count correctly and he probably got paid more. Right? Like $30 million on the shorts. Yeah. Then he probably got to pay another $20 million posting stupid stuff on the internet. Then he got paid $10 million to show up to the Bitcoin conference in an Ethereum shirt.
Yeah. Like, I mean, that was the best part. He showed up in an Ethereum shirt. It was like, dude, read the room a little bit. But yeah, I mean, it's at some point you got to think he's like, he's probably not overwhelmed, I guess. People are handling it for him at some degree. But just like so many things going to one fight where it's like he had the mask sponsored. He was wearing the face mask out there. It's like, dude, everyone's, you know, testing.
Wait, let's go back for a second. I now that I'm thinking about this, I think Saquon would do it too. If somebody said that Saquon and I would each get paid $5 million to do a 40-yard dash.
Who's going to pay you $10
million
to watch?
You race. People would
watch. It's got to be at least competitive. The whole thing about the boxing, why the boxing works.
No, I would smoke him.
No, the whole reason why the boxing.
You really think Saquon could beat me in a 40-yard dash?
Yes.
Wow. Okay. You're fired.
Let's bet a Bitcoin on it.
Huh? Huh?
We go, Yeah, when that came up, he's like, nah, never mind.
No,
yeah,
a sponsor could pay me to race, though.
Okay.
Would you race, too?
For money, yeah.
Yeah, that's what we should do. We should do a four-way race. Shep, Saquon, you, and me. Loser.
Yeah, whoever comes in last.
Loser is banished from the internet forever. Winner gets $5 million, and the other two each get $1 million. So you're definitely banished from the internet.
You know, it's the
and
best.
And then I'm going to win, so I'm going to get $5 million, and the other two are going to get $1 million.
Did you see...
Win, and then you lose.
You know what that reminds me of is when Rovell was trying to box, Darren Rovell was trying to box PFT from Barstool.
That's not real.
Yeah, you never saw this?
No.
But his stipulation was, I forget the exact amount. He wanted millions of dollars, though. And they were like, not going to happen. But PFT was like, I'll meet you anywhere, anytime, any place. And if I win, we'll box. And if I win, you have to stay off the internet for like, it was like 2 years or something. Like 1 or 2 years. Like you just can't use your Twitter account. Or yet, it was either you have to delete it or like you can't use it for a specific period of time. I forget exactly what it was. But he's like, you have to get off the internet. And that was the deal breaker for Rovell. He was like, dude, this is my business. And I have 2 million followers, all this stuff. And it was funny because it's true to some degree, right? Like, that's what he does for a living. But obviously, PFT was like, dude, you can't use Twitter anymore.
If PFT boxed Darren Rovell off the internet, he would be the Hall of Fame immediately. GOAT internet.
Yeah. Oh, my God. That would be pay-per-view, right? Like,
But I think this is where the world's going. As much as I'm joking around about the 40-yard dash, whatever, I literally think that you, me, and let's say Saquon and Shep could literally create enough controversy around an event and literally each get paid 7 figures to go run a 40-yard dash. As crazy as that sounds, Logan Paul just fought Floyd Mayweather, and Floyd Mayweather made like $50 million doing it, and Logan probably made $10 or $20 million doing it.
Yeah.
Like, the world we live in now is so different than the world we used to live in. And some of it is, it's an attention economy. Some of it's just like the market's been manipulated, you know, like crazy. And then some of it, frankly, is just outright who can draw, like who can be the most outrageous against each other and just convince people like, hey, I want to watch this slow car crash.
Well, you get rewarded for obviously building the audience and all that kind of stuff, but also just being authentic and wild to some degree, right? Like, I forget who exactly it was, but all these UFC guys were like, hey, man, we're getting screwed. You know, Logan Paul just made $20 million fighting Floyd Mayweather. Like, why can't I do that? And the reality is like,
because you don't have a million people buying a pay-per-view.
Exactly. Well, not only that, but you don't have 50 million people on between Twitter, Facebook, you know, all these different social platforms. And he does. He has this audience, people that are willing to pay. And they sold 1 million on pay-per-view, right? Like, that's not even some ridiculous amount of money, ridiculous amount of buys. It's not even in the top, I don't think, 25 of all time, but it's around there. And it's, well, he made $65 million. He made $10, $15, mm-hmm. $20 million. So it, obviously the model works. And I agree. I think you're right. The one thing that's fascinating I wrote about the other day was, have you seen what House of Highlights is doing?
No.
House of Highlights, so you know who they are, right? The
Instagram account.
Instagram account. I think they have like 25 million followers.
It's very good. Very well done.
So the story behind House of Highlights is cool. It was a student at Central Florida, Omar, who started the account. He basically was looking for LeBron James was leaving the Miami Heat at the time, and he was going back to Cleveland, and he was looking for highlights of not them in the game, but like the antics they were doing on the sidelines and in the locker room and all the stuff you like heard about and saw sometimes, but he couldn't find them anywhere. So he went to YouTube, couldn't find them, went to Twitter, couldn't find them, and all this stuff, was on Instagram, couldn't find them. So he's like, all right, I'm gonna start a page. And they do some highlights. They do kind of the cool plays and stuff like that. But if you actually look at their page, most of it is outside of that kind of stuff. So it's crazy home videos, it's trick shots, like Dude Perfect, mm-hmm. and all these things. And there's obviously content in the game. But the account blew up. 20 million followers. They got purchased by Bleacher Report, who rolls up to Turner and all this stuff. But now what they're doing, instead of just focusing on that, they're building an entire franchise around live competitions. And it's not live competitions like we think of with the NFL or professional games, finding the best athletes and doing the stuff. Their bet is exactly what celebrity boxing is doing. We're going to find the people that have the largest audiences, and we're going to do super relatable games for high cash prizes. And so what it is they've done a couple now. They did a golf tournament, which was basically just like a longest, I think it was either longest drive or closest to the pin, but some kind of backyard golf tournament. They did a free throw competition, and their next one's a dodgeball tournament. So the free throw competition, they just got a bunch of individual creators, right, with large audiences. Hey, you have 1 million followers on here, you have 2 million here, whatever. Put them all in a free throw competition, winner got $100,000. And the next one is a dodgeball, right, where winner gets $250,000. But what they're doing is they're taking all these like groups, right, so FaZe Clan and all these people that have these massive audiences, and they're pitting them against each other.
Mm-hmm.
So not only do you get the core audience from that group to come, but you're usually these people don't interact, right? So when you put them against kind of a competitor or someone who does something similar to them on the internet, and you put them against each other doing dodgeball, attracts the audience, everyone's engaged, all this type of stuff. So their whole idea is like super engaged audiences coming from large creators. Have live competitions, make it a relatable game that you or I could play, dodgeball, closest to the hole in golf and free throws, and then have high cash prizes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Super low cost to put on. You pay the creators or whatever, and then they're doing the dodgeball tournament in the Warner Brothers parking lot. I think that's where they're doing it, which is like, you know, it's great. It's a dodge. You just need an area that you could do it in the park, right? And that's essentially what they're doing. So it'll be fascinating to see. This is the third one. I think the first two, they didn't have any major sponsors. This one sponsored by, I think, Pizza Hut or something like that. So they got a sponsor. They're monetizing it. And then the interesting part is like what they do with merchandise and products off of all that, right? And it's, you know, only the third iteration. But you could quickly see when you look at celebrity boxing and this, like how they merge together of like, people just want to watch people that they know compete in these things. And sports is one avenue. There's a million different other ways to do it. But it's fascinating to see them kind of combine the two and try to build franchises out of it.
It's going to be unreal to watch all this unfold. It's like a no-brainer. And then all of a sudden, if you start to layer not only athletes, then you talk about some of these internet, you know, communities, then you get musicians, then you get business people. Like, you just start bringing all these people together and you literally can't look away. Like, you have to watch.
Yeah. Well, the internet did an incredible job of not only giving you exposure to these people, but being able to build up the kind of momentum and attention towards these events, right? So you think about a boxing match, you announce it a few months beforehand, you do the weigh-ins, there's gotcha hat, right? Like, it was just incredible content, right? And the one clip of Logan when he left the fight was like, thanks, Jake, for selling the fight for me, right? Because that's exactly what it was.
Is that what he said?
Yeah, he said thanks, right? Like, because that's exactly what it was. He flew in, they got in a scuffle, it went viral on the internet, ESPN's posting about it, all these, you know, people are posting about it. And it just drives attention towards the event.
Is Jake Paul the best marketer on the internet right now?
One of them, for sure. I mean, and people hate it because of his past and who he is and same thing, but right? But you got to separate the two. May have done some terrible things, whatever. Don't always agree with that kind of stuff. Incredible marketer, sure, whatever. There's probably a middle ground. And that's where he is, right? Is like, he does an incredible job of building up kind of the anticipation for these events. Now the UFC guys used to hate him because they're like, this guy's ruining our sport. And now he's arguing against Dana White for them to get paid more. So like, yeah, he's all right. Yeah, they're like, yeah, we like him a little bit.
Yeah, that Jake Paul guy's got a point. Yeah. I think that guy actually is pretty intelligent, Dana.
Yeah.
What'd you say back to him? Okay.
Yeah.
Exactly. Is Dana White the best kind of like league mastermind out of all these?
He's great. He's.
Would the NFL be better off if Dana White was running it?
It's tough to say because the NFL's like, Roger Goodell gets paid, you know, $50 million a year for a reason, right? He obviously does an incredible job, and he works for the owners, and they obviously like him, and they continue to move him over. But Dana White's incredible, right? He took a sport that started in like 1992. I always laugh about the first UFC competition. There was no rules, like literally no rules.
Yeah, it's just a street fight,
and
no gloves, right?
No glove. Some people were wearing like one glove, some wouldn't wear any. Like, it was just mayhem. And what they were doing was they were bringing people from all these different disciplines, right? Jiu-jitsu, taekwondo, street fighters, and just putting them in a ring.
Sumo wrestlers.
No judges, right? So like, it could not end unless it was a knockout or someone gave up. And there was just no rules, right? So it was kind of barbaric. I think John McCain called it human cockfighting. And he was like, I'll never let this get anywhere. And it has, obviously. Dana White bought it for, I think it was $2 million or whatever. It's, you know, almost a $10 billion company now. But one of the things Dana White did really well was he understood really, really early on what everyone understands now very clearly, which is the audience and the attention. When they were struggling, they were about to go bankrupt. They had already pumped like $60 million into it on top of what they bought the company for. And the Fertitta brothers were like, hey, you know, we need to start seeing some progress here. So he had the Ultimate Fighter. He came up with the TV show, if people remember it on Spike TV. But what people don't know about it was that he went to like five or six different networks at first and were like, hey, we want to do the show. Will you guys do it? Whatever. And everyone said no. Like, this is, because remember, it was barbaric at the time. No one watched it. Everyone thought it was like kind of ridiculous and whatever. And we've come to kind of be immune to that to some degree, right? Like, we don't think about that as much anymore. But at the time, no one wanted to touch it. He said, okay, Spike TV, I'll pay the $10 million ourselves. We'll invest $10 million for the production. We'll pay for everything. You guys just put it on TV. They put it on TV. Maybe there was some kind of like revenue share, whatever it might be, but he paid $10 million to get it produced. Show's a hit. They went from doing like 50,000 or 100,000 pay-per-view buys. They did a million the next year on an event.
Wow.
So crazy, just of just getting in front of people. Because I don't even think it was necessarily as much about just getting more eyeballs on the sport. It was showing that the fighters are actual people, right? And you were seeing people kind of in their bed calling their wife, training all day, saying, hey, look, I really need to win this next fight to make paychecks, to be able to buy us food and groceries, and all this stuff, right? So you just see that human aspect of the fighters. So I think that was incredible. But the other one that is even less talked about was when all these leagues, remember when Twitter was like younger, right? 08, 10, whatever. Leagues were banning or fining people for saying anything basically on Twitter. You just couldn't, unless it was like promotional tweets and like building your brand, like they didn't want anything. And it's completely changed kind of the perception. But the NFL was handing out fines, NBA was handing out fines. They just generally didn't really want you to do it, just scared kind of what you would say. Dana White actually created a fund and he said, I'm going to hand out cash payments to whoever tweets the most and whoever gets the most followers. He had a bunch of metrics that was basically like, I'm gonna give you 5,000, 10,000, 50,000, whatever, to whoever has the best performance on Twitter this month or this quarter. And what it did was it just built up the sport, right? And it, guys like McGregor now, it obviously wasn't as big then, but it's exactly the approach they've taken of kind of like just having these fighters build up their personas on Twitter and attracting an audience, showing they're human. And that was off the heels of The Ultimate Fighter and seeing how kind of the success of that show parlayed the success of the UFC. So I thought that was cool.
I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah.
That he's literally paying for the winner.
To be active on Twitter.
I mean, should I be rich if that was the case? All right. Where can we send people to find you on the internet? Where should they should they go to Twitter, email?
Yeah, I mean, Twitter's...
what's your Twitter account?
The easiest, at Joe Pompliano.
I mean, you're the second best Pomp account on Twitter behind John Pomp.
Well, from a quality perspective...
John's in the room. He just gave me a little, you know...
Yeah, John's got a good Twitter account. He's the numbers guy. yeah.
Joe, I mean, how much of your content does John find for you?
Zero. I was gonna lie, but I give him the benefit of the doubt. But this is gonna be recorded and etched in history. So let's stick with zero.
All right, just making sure. So at Joe Pompliano.
Yeah.
All right, and then email. You send it what every morning?
Every morning, Monday through Friday.
I mean,
9 to 9:30.
Let me just. I'll just say this. So I wake up and I write mine in like 30 minutes. Like I'm just like done. Send. It's great. People love it. Big audience, like highly engaged, big open rate. You know, I'm not going to brag, but like pretty good. And then Joe, you wake up, what, 5:30? And it takes you 4 hours to write this. And one day I was like, man, what is this guy writing about?
So I
never read it. But hold on, I never read it. So I went and I read it.
And I should remove you from the list.
And it was actually good. Like I was surprised. And I was like, oh, this is why it takes them 4 hours to write this, is because you actually do research and there's numbers and data. So like, it's actually very good. But it does take you 4 hours, which makes me like to give you shit for it. But where can they go to sign up for the email?
Thanks for that intro for the letter. ReadHuddleUp.com.
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 All right. Huddle up. Like the quarterback calling everyone, huddle up.
That was the idea behind the name.
Was it really?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then do you say like, you know.
I don't ever say it like that.
Wait, well, how do you say it?
Huddle up.
Oh, you say like normal.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the quarterback always, you know, huddle up. And then everyone comes together and he's like, all right, on two, ready, break.
We know how it works.
All right. Go follow him at Joe Pompliano. Go subscribe at readhuddleup.com. You can even say it, huddle up. And we'll do it again in the future.